up, Pharmacy Nation? I'm Pharmacy Joe. Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care pharmacy podcast. This is episode 212. In this episode, I'll be joined by two experts in the field of adult veno-arterial extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, Doctor of Emergency Medicine, Joe Belezzo, and Doctor of Pharmacy, Ashkan Kabazian. I have all the links discussed in today's show in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode212. If you know someone who would find this podcast helpful, please share it with them. The next masterclass for my Critical Care Academy will go live August 4th, 2017, and will be a deeper dive into specific practical aspects of the pharmacotherapy of ECMO. You can sign up to be part of the Academy at pharmacyjoe.com/academy. Now, let's start the interview. Dr. Joe Belezzo is Chairman of Emergency Medicine at Sharp Memorial Hospital in San Diego, California. Joe was the first emergency medicine trained physician to successfully perform ECPR as salvage therapy in a patient with refractory cardiac arrest. Together with Zach Shinar, Joe co-hosts the ED ECMO podcast, is co-chair of the Emergency Department ECMO program at his hospital, and is the host of the Endovascular Resuscitation Conference, Reanimate. Dr. Ashkan, or Ash Kabazian, currently serves as lead emergency room clinical pharmacist at Sharp Memorial Hospital in San Diego. He received his Doctor of Pharmacy from the University of Michigan in 2004, and then completed a general practice residency at Scripps Mercy Hospital in San Diego, California. The best part of Ash's bio was provided to me by Dr. Belezzo, who says, "Ashkan is truly the man in RED. He's changed the way we practice emergency medicine and is a true innovator. When I'm coding a patient, regardless of whether we are using ECMO, REBOA, ACLS, or just Wi-Fi, he's there pushing the envelope. He comes to me all the time with suggestions on how to best manage pharmacy issues." Joe and Ashkan, welcome and thank you for being here.
Pharmacy Joe, thank you for having us on the show.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you. Let's get started. I understand ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Can you explain exactly what that entails?
Yeah, so ECMO, this is Belezzo, by the way. So ECMO is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and that is a historical term that is now almost nearly obsolete, although we have continued to use it. What this really is, in lay terms, is complete and total heart-lung bypass. So we will take a patient who is either dying or in cardiogenic shock or some form of shock, and access their femoral vessels, their femoral artery and femoral vein. And in doing so, we can take all the blood volume out of their femoral vein or out of the right atrium, pass it through a pump, through an oxygenator, and then back into the body, going retrograde up the aorta. And in doing so, we completely bypass the heart and the lungs temporarily in an effort to fix a problem that has caused their devastating collapse, be that a heart attack, pulmonary embolism, drug overdose, hypothermia, dysrhythmia, and the list goes on.
Awesome. So there's a couple different cannulation strategies for ECMO, AV and VV. And I understand what you do is AV ECMO. When would you use AV versus VV ECMO?
So AV stands for arterial venous ECMO, and that's what I just described to you, which is taking all the blood out from the femoral vein and by default the right artery, the right atrium, and then passing it back into the femoral artery. VV ECMO is veno-venous ECMO, and that's where you're taking all the blood out of the vein and putting it back into the venous system, and that is lung bypass only. That will not allow bypass of the heart.
Okay, so in order to do VV ECMO, you've got to have still the patient has to have their own cardiac output.
That's exactly correct. So we'll use that in not so much in the emergency department, but it'll be used in the intensive care unit in a situation like where a patient has ARDS and they have maximized all of their ventilatory function and they're still flailing. So in that sort of situation, we might put somebody on VV ECMO just to bypass their lungs long enough for their lungs to recover that injury.
Gotcha. Now, As long as I've known ECMO, I've always thought, yeah, that's something that happens in the OR. We're going to send the patient to the OR, and they're going to come back to us on the magic ECMO machine. So what are you doing with ECMO in the ED, and how might that be different than how it happens in the OR?
Joe, you bring up a really good point. And I think traditionally that's been the application of AV ECMO or VA ECMO, is support of patients who have come out of cardiac surgery and then have a collapse for some reason. And so VA ECMO has been traditionally used in adults to support postoperative patients. The House of Medicine has realized that there is a subset of patients who have a cardiac arrest or develop cardiogenic shock, and they're recoverable, but they just need enough time to fix the problem. The classic example would be somebody who suffered a ventricular fibrillation arrest and comes into the ER in refractory VFib. So, you know, there's situations where there's a young person that has a large cardiac lesion or a block of one of their coronary vessels, and we simply can't keep them alive long enough to get them to the cath lab. And in those situations, traditionally, we would call the code. What we have been doing now is we transitioned the use of VA ECMO from the operating room down to the emergency department, and we can put these patients on heart-lung bypass, giving them enough time to have the cardiologist go in this particular situation and remove that, or, you know, bypass or remove that clot or do a percutaneous coronary intervention in that particular situation.
Wow, fantastic. What kind of outcomes do you see with ECMO initiated in the ED?
So this is a relatively new thing. We've been doing this for 6 years now. There are multiple groups around the world that are also doing this. There are groups in Taiwan and Japan, Australia, France, as well as the rest of Europe, and in some places in Canada. And the cumulative outcomes are much better for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest than the cumulative outcomes prior to the initiation of ECMO. So just by way of giving you some numbers, if you have your cardiac arrest today in, anywhere outside of an ECMO center or a place that can initiate ED ECMO, your chance grossly of having walking out of the hospital neurologically intact is about 8% or so, and that's US-wide. So far, studies are varying, but the studies that we have thus far suggest that if you initiate ECMO in a patient who has had an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, their recovery neurologically intact is somewhere between 28 and 32%. So quite a bit better. And I can tell you that there are studies coming out of primarily out of the University of Minnesota right now that are showing numbers even better than that, above 40%, which is amazing.
Wow. That is fantastic. You're referring to, I think, the episode you just did, 36, on your ED ECMO podcast, Dimitris Yiannopoulos.
Yeah, I'll give a shout out to Dimitris. He's an amazing individual, interventional cardiologist who's changing the way that we practice in terms of dealing with out-of-hospital cardiac arrests.
Yeah, I listened to that episode recently. I'll put a link to that in our show notes, and it's really cool. Incredible. He's basically bringing people from the community straight to the cath lab, somehow gets them on ECMO within 6 minutes, and then has excellent outcomes.
Yeah. You know, when you're doing as much ECMO as he's doing, you tend to get, like anything else, you tend to get good at it when you've done a lot of them.
Yeah. Now, is there an organization out there that provides patient care guidelines for the use of ECMO?
So there's really two. The big one that most people would be aware of is the Extracorporeal Life Support Organization, which the acronym is ELSO. They've been around for decades. They have the largest registry of ECMO patients and provide a very significant component of the guidelines. Now, I can just say that ELSO is a huge service to all of us who are performing ECMO. But their focus over the years has been mostly on the point of initiation to the point of weaning from ECMO. And the thing that the second group that I'll just mention is our own. We have a Reanimate conference and the ED ECMO podcast. Our goals are the front end of that. So soup to nuts. From the time the patient arrests to the time they get onto bypass. And we're in the process now of establishing the guidelines as we see they should be.
Excellent. And that's edecmo.org?
That's correct. Thanks. And then the conference, if anybody's interested in learning this hands-on, is the Reanimate Conference. Reanimate, call one word, reanimateconference.com.
Great. All those links will be in the show notes too. So let's start to get into a little bit of the pharmacy stuff, since we do have Ashkan here. When you're initiating ECMO, obviously the patient is coding, and epinephrine may be initiated. What's the difference between epinephrine in the ACLS algorithm and then once you have ECMO started?
That's a great question. So as you guys know, when a patient is pulseless, we give epi every 3 to 5 minutes. Now, up until we start the ECMO circuit, we'd be giving epinephrine routinely, typically. Now, we can have a whole other podcast discussing the role of epinephrine and if actually we're doing any harm with epinephrine and what it does, but that's a different topic altogether. But the point is that once ECMO is started, the patient is still quote-unquote pulseless. However, now they have flow. So once ECMO is started, we want to stop boluses of epi.
Gotcha. Okay. And you might do a vasopressor if they need it with a continuous infusion?
I'll start off that one. You know, as soon as you get a patient onto heart-lung bypass, they've had upwards of 30 minutes to 60 minutes of no endogenous cardiac output. Their heart hasn't been beating. You've been supplementing their perfusion with chest compressions. And so at the time that you get them on heart-lung bypass, their heart is stunned, and it will remain stunned for sometimes hours, sometimes days. And so after we get them on bypass, we then have to make the decision about whether or not, you know, what are the pluses and minuses of adding a vasopressor. And I'll let Ashkan talk a little bit about the vasopressors that we use in a patient who just got done with ECMO.
Yeah, it's a great point. So one, these patients need fluid, right? So we give fluid and we go down the traditional pathway and make sure the flow rate is optimized. Then which pressor should we use in ECMO? Well, one thought is that you need peripheral squeeze when a patient is on ECMO. However, if their heart is not functioning via, you know, the echo or something, giving just peripheral squeeze can lead to left ventricular failure and pulmonary edema, which is obviously not good. So if the patient is on VV ECMO and they have good cardiac output, then you can consider a peripheral acting agent such as a vasopressin. We tend to like vasopressin in these patients because most of them are acidotic. Now, if the patient has poor cardiac output in traditional ECMO, then you might want to consider a norepi type drug, which still gives you some beta activity. But again, you know, the pressor is not the end all in these situations because obviously you need fluid, you need blood, the flow rate has to go. But you should start thinking about what pressor should be initiated in these patients based on cardiac output and what's going on with the patient.
Okay. Now, are you dosing the vasopressin more along the lines of sepsis dosing where you're just going at 0.03 units per minute, or are you going up to the higher doses used for low cardiac output syndrome, like up to 0.1 units per minute?
That's a great point. Typically, we're just doing the traditional 0.3 to 0.4 dosing scheme, but we've actually debated this for some time as far as the role of vasopressin in code. I'll let Dr. Belezzo jump in here on this.
So the controversy that seems to exist is whether or not vasopressin, when you're vasopressin replete, when the body is vasopressin replete, does further vasopressin have any further effect? And even more so, does that have any adverse effect? And I'll challenge your listeners because I am not sure of the answer to this one myself, but I've been trained that if you are vasopressin depleted, that vasopressin will have a positive effect. But once you've saturated receptors, you're going to have no further vasopressin effect. So my practice has been in every patient to start a vasopressin drip at fixed dose, as Ashkan said. But that's the thought process behind it. Is it going to cause any harm if you put it on and don't need it?
Gotcha. Yeah, that's my understanding. If you're depleted, you should be exquisitely sensitive to even a low dose of vasopressin. And then if not, then yeah, it either doesn't do too much or perhaps even can cause ischemia to the limbs that you don't want.
So, but does that allow you to decrease the amount of total vasopressor that you need, whether that's one with a beta agonist or just pure alpha? Does the addition of vasopressin provide enough support that you could limit the amount of further vasopressors that you give?
Yeah, that's great. Now, from my point of view, treating someone with sepsis, yes, your dose of norepinephrine should go down. Do you see the same, Ashkin, with ECMO patients?
Not enough patients to really give a concrete answer, but in theory, I believe we would.
Great. So when you've got the blood flowing through the oxygenator, there's got to be some risk of thrombus development there. What's that look like, and how is that best managed?
So there is risk, and every person that you put on to heart-lung bypass, they will have clot that forms in the oxygenator. And quite honestly, that's just an expected thing that happens. The clot formation itself is not that big of an issue, other than it will gum up the oxygenator in due time. So the longer that you let that happen, you know, we're talking days to sometimes even weeks, the oxygenator may become bad, for lack of a better term, and may need to be cut out and put a new oxygenator in if it becomes gummed up with clot. Now, remember that the oxygenator now is functioning just like your lung. And if you think about it, you know, I was telling Ashkan this before the show. They did a study many years ago looking at autopsies of patients who died of other issues. They might have had a stroke or a heart attack. And doing autopsies on them, you found that there was a significant number of patients, some 80% of patients or something, had clinically insignificant pulmonary emboli. So your lungs are ongoingly acting as a filter for your brain to prevent your brain from getting strokes. And so much the same way, even if you're reversing the circulation, which is what you're doing in ECMO, in VA ECMO, you're now pulling blood out of the body and sucking it through this pushing it through this oxygenator. And when you do so, any clot that forms will get caught up in that oxygenator and allow free blood then beyond the oxygenator to go back up into the aorta. And so what your brain is seeing is hopefully non-clotted blood. So in reality, having thrombosis occur at the level of the oxygenator is a sort of a safety event. It's a form of protecting your brain from stroke.
Yeah, I'll add one thing. And something we see my colleagues in the ICU see frequently is that when patients are on ECMO, it seems like AT3 is being used quite a bit. And you will, if a patient is on heparin in addition to ECMO, you will see escalating doses of heparin being needed to maintain therapeutic ATT. To my knowledge, there's no really one correct answer to treat that. Some people give FFP, some people just let it ride. But I think if you are treating a clot with heparin in the units, and you notice that you have to give more and more heparin to achieve therapeutic ABTT, it requires maybe a discussion with the perfusionist in the team as far as what other things you might be able doing to help mitigate that situation.
Gotcha. So are these patients routinely on some level of anticoagulation while they're on ECMO? Oh.
Point of clarity, Joe. Our goal is not to cause clot. We're not using the oxygenator as the only form of preventing clot from hitting the brain and the body. No, absolutely. So when all of these patients get a bolus of heparin, and the priming bags, so what ends up going into the circuit, the fluid that fills the circuit before we put a patient on heart-lung bypass also has heparin within it. So we use two bags, and each bag that's going to fill the circuit has 2,500 units of heparin in it. So yes, all anticoagulated. And I should also say that the tubing that contain the PVC tubing that the blood comes through is all heparin bonded. The company that we happen to use uses their own proprietary heparin bonding, but it's all heparin bonded.
Gotcha. And are you using PTT or anti-10A levels to monitor your heparin?
You can use either. We personally use anti-10, but you can use either, and you'll find that practice varies.
So how about drug sequestration? How does that happen? What drugs are affected?
So that's a good point. So there's a lot of things going on in these patients, right? You have patient factors. Is the patient big, small? What's their renal function, hepatic function? Then you have circuit issues. But if we're talking about just the physical properties of a drug and how that leads to drug sequestration, let me start with this. One, What is drug sequestration? That means a drug is binding to the ECMO circuit and it's not getting into the body. So it's the drug is being rendered inactive by way of being caught in the ECMO circuit. There are some things that affect what drugs get bound within the circuit, things like molecular size, degree of ionization, type of tubing used, age of circuit. But what I try to do in these patients to think of what drugs get sequestered is I try to remember three things. And if you remember these three things, you'll have a general idea of how drugs are affected in ECMO. One, the degree of protein binding. Two, the lipophilicity. And three, hydrophilicity. If you can remember just these three properties of drugs, you'll have a general idea of what drugs get sequestered and theoretically to what extent. Also, volume and distribution is important, but those three things help quite a bit. And it appears that within the tubing, you know, there's the cannula, there's the PVC tubing, there's a centrifuge pump, and then there's this gas exchange membrane, as Dr. Belezzo went into. It seems that the PVC tubing and the gas exchange membrane are the primary sites for drug sequestration.
Gotcha.
And I will say this, you know, I wish I could come here and tell you exactly how much of a drug binds and what's going to happen in ECMO patients. But, you know, we're kind of limited to ex vivo studies and small case reports. There's not this hunk of data out there that's going to be able to let us know exactly which way to go. However, there is a trial going on now that should be published really soon called the ASAP trial. It's this prospective, multi-centered, open-label trial. It's evaluating 19 drugs. I think it's out of Australia and New Zealand. It's over a three-year period. They're actually checking drug levels, and I think this is going to really revolutionize the way in which we look at drug sequestration in ECMO, and I'm really excited to read that trial when it comes out.
Great. Yeah, that sounds like it'll be very helpful. Now, you mentioned age of the circuit. How is that going to have an impact for drug loss or sequestration?
So when we look at a drug like Versed, for example, in patients that are on ECMO, there are some small trials saying that you're going to require escalating doses of Versed over time. Now, it seems to be that it's more than just pharmacodynamic receptor, you know, tolerance. The problem is there's not a lot of good data for me to come here and say the longer the circuit, the more drug gets bound. It makes sense to me that happens over time. There are some people that do believe that the age of the circuit is related to more drugs being bound, but I really don't have a good concrete answer to say exactly this is what happens. Again, I'm really looking forward to that ASAP trial for me to be able to give you a better recommendation as far as how the age of the circuit truly affects drug kinetics.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll find there that the circuit could possibly get saturated and maybe you'd have less sequestration over time with an older circuit because it's all the binding sites in the circuit are taken up.
Yeah, that's a great point. So there's kind of two ways you can think about this. One is that the tubing and the membrane are infinite in space, right? They're just you're just going to continue to bind because it's, you know, the surface area is just so much greater than the amount of drug you're giving. And then the other kind of school of thought could be that, yeah, you're right, it saturates. And then once you reach the saturation point, boom, your drug levels are going to skyrocket. And again, I really don't know the answer to that question, but it's definitely something we look for and think about when we're giving particularly lipophilic meds that are highly protein bound in ECMO circuits.
Great. So, you know, this is something I guess you're really going to have to be paying attention to the patient's response and maybe considering if you changed the oxygenator or something in the circuit and all of a sudden they don't appear to be sedated as well, that could be related.
Great point. Yeah.
And what kind of what target, speaking of sedation, I guess, what target RAS score or whatever other sedative score you use are you shooting for in these patients? Is it they need to be deeply sedated or should we be doing as light as possible sedation as we do with our other patients to prevent delirium?
I'll make that very clear is that in these VA ECMO patients, our runs are as short as possible. 3 to 5 days are ideal. So in these cases, any movement is high risk for the cannulas becoming dislodged, and you dislodge a arterial cannula, and that's the equivalent of a gunshot wound to the femoral artery, and that's hemorrhagic shock, and they'll die from that. So deep sedation is the goal during the course of a 3 to 5 day VA ECMO run, with an occasional purposeful, allow them to wake a bit to see what their brain function is, if you're trying to determine whether or not this is a brain death kind of a patient.
Yeah, I'll also jump in here as far as the type of agents we use to sedate during ECMO. When you first look this stuff up, if you look up a drug like dexmedetomidine, Versed, fentanyl, propofol, you'll see these crazy drug sequestration rates, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of the drug being sequestered. And you'll think, man, maybe we shouldn't use these drugs in ECMO patients, right, from these ex vivo trials. However, in our experience, and I think in a lot of different ICUs and ERs across the nation, we are not seeing drug failure, right? So this the clinical outcome doesn't appear to correlate with the degree of sequestration that we're reading about. So what we typically do is we will start whatever you have on hand, what is clinically appropriate for the patient, and kind of roll with that, right? So whether it be propofol or fentanyl, Versed. However, we do think of sequestration when we're dosing. So our upper limits, we will be able to push the upper limits a little bit faster. Now, I will say this. If you are giving a lipophilic, highly protein-bound medication sedative in ECMO, and you're escalating, and you're not seeing the level of response, then I think a light bulb should go off in your head and consider an alternative agent. An alternative agent might include something like a morphine Ativan. They seem to sequester less than the other agents. But for the most part, clinically, we just start with what we're going to start, monitor appropriately, have rather higher dosing cap ranges, and then if you see failure, then you can consider switching to something less lipophilic.
Thank you. So if movement and dislodgement of the catheter is potentially so catastrophic, are these patients paralyzed as well as sedated?
No. Generally speaking, it's a bad plan. In any critical care situation, we really don't recommend paralysis other than the initial, while we're initially intubating and performing RSI right up front. Aside from that, though, no, our general rule is make sure pain's controlled, fentanyl drip, and then adding on whatever sedative is needed to keep deep sedation.
Great. So how about antibiotics or antimicrobials in general? They've got to be affected as far as their pharmacokinetics and ECMO. Are there any general rules that can be applied to different classes of antimicrobials?
That's a great question. So there's kind of the golden rule here, and that is if you have a patient on ECMO and they're on some kind of antimicrobial therapy and you have sensitivity data back, but the patient's not getting better, they're remaining afebrile, or the white count keeps going up, again, there should be a light bulb going on thinking that, wow, maybe this drug is being sequestered in the membrane and I'm not achieving, you know, appropriate drug over MIC levels. So that's kind of the one point. I'll break it down into sections. And one is the beta-lactams. In general, the expanded spectrum penicillin, cephalosporins, and carbapenems, these guys are generally hydrophilic, largely renally cleared meds with low to moderate protein binding. So we don't see as much sequestration as we see, again, with those lipophilic protein-bound meds. As a general rule, you know, meds that are hydrophilic with low volumes of distribution, we don't see as much sequestration in membranes. They're more prone to dilution, which we can talk about later. But in general, so the beta-lactams, you just dose them how you would regularly dose them. I like to be more aggressive, particularly because these patients are critical and they're on circuit. You do see some degree of dilution and some degree of sequestration. So I like the, you know, whenever you can, give an extended infusion. Always critical in these patients with these antibiotics is give a loading dose. If there's one thing I can kind of get across here is load your patients, because you're going to be giving extra fluid in the ECMO circuit. Again, these patients are critical with low perfusion. So one, we load the patient. So in general, you know, meropenem, I like the longer dosing. You know, next we can have, you know, vanco, for example. You know, the good thing with vanco and the aminoglycosides is as follows. We have levels to go off of. So anytime you're monitoring, you know, giving an antibiotic where you can check levels, well, that's your answer, right? So vanco and the aminoglycosides don't appear to be affected as much as some of the other agents are. But again, we have levels to go off of. you know, quinolones, you know, I've seen some stuff with Cipro, which is a lipophilic med, but with low protein binding, and it doesn't seem to be affected by the ECMO circuit. So I would feel comfortable giving Cipro, again, you know, on the higher end of our dosing strategy. The antivirals, I really don't know about antivirals as much. I have seen some pediatric stuff with acyclovir being used and ECMO with relatively good outcomes. So I would feel relatively comfortable using acyclovir. If your patient is on Tamiflu, for example, that does not appear to be affected by ECMO. And lastly, it's the antifungal group. That's kind of, it's kind of tricky. So there's limited data. And again, with all this stuff, there's like, you know, there's not much strong data coming out saying, you know, large scale data telling us what to do. So I'm making some extrapolations. But I will say this, fluconazole doesn't appear to be significantly effective. But what does appear to be significantly effective is voriconazole levels significantly. So I would try not to use voriconazole in ECMO, but if I had to, I would really escalate the dose. It also makes sense from a theoretical standpoint that your lipophilic amphotericin B, posaconazole, will be sequestered in the membrane. I've seen some stuff with caspofungin saying that you know, around 50% of it gets found. Some trials say that patients do fine with caspofungin, and then some other small trials show that you know, none of the caspofungin gets in. And I don't know the answer to this, and this is going to be kind of theoretical, but one, if a patient is on ECMO, treating with antifungals is probably not going to be your number one priority. It's going to be, you know, stabilizing that patient. But if you absolutely had to treat with some kind of resistant fungal organism, you know, one could consider continuous infusion amphotericin B. Again, I haven't seen any data on this, but from a theoretical standpoint, it makes sense. Or just give them high-dose fluconazole until you can take them off circuit.
Gotcha.
I'm going to actually walk us back from Nerdville for 1 second. I will say that you know, a study done out of General Resuscitation 2013 showing that early antibiotics improve survival following out of hospital cardiac arrest. Lots of theories as to why that may or may not be true, but in the ER when we're doing ECMO, these are as sterile as they can possibly be, the procedure. But quite honestly, throwing antibiotics at them right off the bat up front is highly recommended.
Yeah, that actually brings up a really good point as far as what I try to do when I approach an ECMO patient, right? So you have several physicians in the room. They're all gowned up. There's blood, you know, the bunch of nurses, and it seems like a kind of a chaotic environment. So one thing I like to consider is I'm not going to be able to debate with Dr. Belezzo or Joe here about what the EKG looks like, how the cannulization is done, what the flow rate is. So I kind of step back and I kind of let them do their thing in that situation. But there's three points that I think a good clinical pharmacist should do that would make a very positive impact. One, once a patient's put on ECMO, the first thing I think of is sedation. Do we give rock to this patient? Pharmacy Joe, you've talked about this before very, very eloquently in that when a clinical pharmacist is at the bedside, sedation gets started faster. And so oftentimes they're dealing with so much that I try to remember one, sedation. Does this patient require sedation, and what sedatives should we implement and at what doses? Two, antibiotics. Oftentimes these patients need antibiotics. You also had a podcast a while back that talked about giving vanco and cefepime in a liter bag in these patients. I think that makes sense. Or if you can just push something, get something started and load it aggressively when ECMO starts. And then number three, pressors. After the flow has been set and the patient has been stabilized, what pressors should you recommend? What does the echo show as far as what pressors you might want to recommend? What's the pH of the drug? So again, let me just reiterate that one time. After ECMO started, patient stabilized, there's three things I think a clinical pharmacist should think of: sedation, antibiotics, and pressors.
And from the clinical side, let me just say that there's nothing more important than having Oshkon at the bedside with me. It allows us as docs who are managing a lot of different things, ECMO circuits and calling the cardiologist and calling the OR and dealing with all these things, that the cognitive offload that allows me to have a good clinical pharmacist at the bedside saying, hey, doc, you want to give some antibiotics? Hey, doc, can we go up on the sedation? You know, the Rocky Road We're off in about 4 to 5 minutes. Should we make sure we're sedated? Hey, doc, your MAP is 62. At what point do you want me to start the Levofed? I can just say that clinically, it's all the world. It's a big difference if you have a clinical pharmacist who can be at the bed and do that for you.
Yeah, and you guys know this. A good sporting analogy. You sport fans out there, is I try to think of the clinical pharmacist as the offensive line in football, right? So the offensive line wins games, right? And it can make the quarterback look really good. And so I try to think of myself as kind of the offensive lineman. What can I do here to help this patient and help the team in critical situations?
That's awesome. There's so much gold there. I just want to unpack a little bit of it. First, Joe, thanks for that testimonial for pharmacists at the bedside. That's really all we're looking for, is to be seen that way. And, I know certain pharmacists may not come across that way at first, but really what you said is what all of us are aiming for when we're in the room trying to help out the team. So let me recap that. From your point of view as a physician, what would you say you want pharmacists to know that are helping you care for patients on ECMO?
I think Ashkan said it best. I can't summarize this any better. Is if I know that Ashkan or another one of our clinical pharmacists is at the bedside, I can focus. I know I can focus on things other than the pharmacy, other than the drugs. And I know that Ashkan's going to step up and take care of that. And that gives me a lot of leeway to think about clinically related things, patient related things. It really, that, as I said, the cognitive offload that allows a physician is huge.
Awesome.
Yeah, and practice makes perfect for pharmacists that are just starting out or aren't as comfortable in these situations. It's great being mentored by someone that has done this before. And the way that you're going to learn this stuff is actually going to the bedside and watching the patient, right? If this is an alcoholic patient that is moving around and you start propofol at, five, maybe that's not, right? The more you see this stuff, the more you watch as you dose titrate and what happens with the blood pressure, the better you get at it. So I would say if this kind of stuff makes you nervous initially, if you don't go out there and you don't go to the bedside, you're always going to be nervous. So kind of get out there, see it, watch the patient, see what your recommendations do as far as vital signs are concerned, and then it becomes better over time. It is kind of like an art, and I do not have all the answers, but I try to just think of what is most appropriate in those situations and see what my recommendations do per patient, and then over time you'll find trends that will help you get better and better over time.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. You really have to get right in the room. I remember, I don't know how many years ago, over 10 years ago, standing outside the room in the ED, and then finally, getting the courage to walk in and kind of figure out how can a pharmacist help out. It's kind of like the final frontier for pharmacy in the ED. And one other piece of advice I'll get is find an experienced nurse, because they are the ones that, if you develop a relationship with them, they're the ones that are gently going to tell you, you can't start propofol at 5 in this patient. He's going to punch the nurse in the nose and
right.
And that kind of stuff. As far as what you said about what to evaluate, that's actually perfect. We didn't plan this, but I put out to the listeners what they wanted me to ask. And one of the questions was, what should a pharmacist know who is evaluating an existing ECMO patient for the very first time when they come on shift? So it sounds like that's sedation, antibiotics, and pressors.
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point. And kind of that 1-2-3 analogy really will help, especially in a really chaotic environment.
Great. How about when ECMO is turned off and the patient begins to circulate on their own? Anything from pharmacotherapy or other perspective that we need to know about?
Yes, this is still, more academic, but I think it clinically makes sense. When you are giving a drug, particularly a lipophilic, highly protein-bound medication with a narrow therapeutic window, and you are dose titrating based on sequestration, and you got the patient dialed in, if you turn that ECMO circuit off, you theoretically are going to give extra drug to the patient and maybe make them supratherapeutic or potentially toxic. So there is one school of thought in that what you can do is giving patients, some ketamine, and retitrating your sedatives up again, which I think makes sense. But I guess the most important thing to note here is that, remember, drugs are being bound, especially lipophilic, you know, sedative agents are being bound in the ECMO circuit. When you turn that circuit off, you're potentially increasing the amount of drug that can get into the body, even if you don't increase the drug dosing per se. So your bioavailability, quote unquote, will go up. So retitrate down and evaluate the patient closely at that moment. At least go to the bedside and watch the patient when that ECMO circuit is turned off to be able to evaluate the patient clinically.
And when you say ketamine, you're talking about an anesthetic dose?
I think so. I think so in these patients. You know, it would all depend on, you know, is the patient awake or is the patient still sedated? If the patient obviously needs full sedation, I wouldn't give a small dose of ketamine, and I would give, you know, at least 1 to 2 mg/kg IV.
Great. Yeah, the go big or go home dosing strategy.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of folks also wrote to me with this question. There's going to be a lot of pharmacists listening who don't have ED ECMO at their center, but are really going to be interested in what you're doing. And they're going to want to know, how can they kind of get the process started? Obviously, a lot of other physician stakeholders are going to be key, and nursing and other departments. But what is the best way for someone to try to get the ball rolling at their institution for this kind of practice?
So you probably asked the most challenging question there is. That's the biggest question that we get either through ED ECMO or at our Reanimate conference is, you know, how do I deal with all the various layers of bureaucracy to make this happen? And there's not one good answer because it's going to be different at each place. But I will say this. If you're at a hospital that has a heart program of any kind, you're at a hospital that is doing heart surgery, then you may not even know it, but likely you have an ECMO machine upstairs that's meant to support them. So all of the nursing training, all of the supply line chain, all of the upkeep is already done. And really what you need to do is try to find a champion in the ER who's willing to take this on, because these things are mobile machines. If they're already in-house, the hospital is already paying for them, the overhead's already done, then the hospital and administrators should be they should enjoy the fact that you're applying this to a new volume of patients, a new group of patients in the emergency room. So that's what I say is, you know, just take a look. If you're at a place that has a heart program, go ask some questions upstairs, and more than likely you've got an ECMO machine sitting up there that the administrators would love to have you dust off.
Gotcha. That's perfect. Anything else that you folks want me to highlight or ask or just free form discuss?
The only thing I'd say is, and I'm probably using the wrong term because I don't understand this this pharmacodynamics and kinetic stuff, I don't know if the term's volume of distribution, but if you have drug going through a machine that can carry certain fluid and you either turn the machine or turn the machine on or off, it seems like the total amount of drug, or is it a concentration that's in the blood?
So it depends on if that drug is fat-loving or water-loving. If it is a hydrophilic drug, which is water-loving, and you add fluid, especially if you add fluid fast, hydrophilic drugs are particularly susceptible to fluid shifts. So if you add a bunch of fluid, all of a sudden you're going to decrease the concentration of that drug. If the drug is fat-loving and it's stored more in the fat cells, it's not going to be as dependent on the volume in which you give the patient. So initially, we see a big decrease in drug concentrations for hydrophilic medications, particularly with low volumes of distribution. And then over time, so that's, for example, antibiotics fall into that category. So you'd want to give a large dose. And then over time, lipophilic drugs with high protein binding tend to sequester on the membranes more, and then that's kind of your problem there. You know, it also seems that albumin binds to membranes, which we didn't talk about. And, you know, if you have albumin binding to membranes, you also have, you know, that's why these lipophilic, highly protein bound drugs tend to sequester more on the membrane circuit itself.
Gotcha.
I will just freestyle one point to kind of summarize some stuff here is that when you're looking at drugs in ECMO, it's hard to memorize every single drug. Even if you kind of read, you know, 10 different articles, it's hard to remember that when you hit that patient. So some general principles that I like to think about is if you're titrating to effect, then you have something to titrate to. If you have a drug which is lipophilic, highly protein bound, start thinking of sequestration. If you have a hydrophilic medication with low protein binding and low volume of distribution, think loading dose and then less over time. And I wish this was all in a box, you know, and it was just ECMO we were talking about. What complicates this matter, and this is why some of the ex vivo data might not apply to actual clinical patients, is that there's other things going on. Is there renal function improving? Is there hepatic function getting worse? You know, there are so many variables that go on here, and we didn't even talk about flow rates. Is the flow rate of the ECMO changing the drug kinetics? And there's a lot of things to think of. So I try to just think about the principles of this matter and go on a principle-based kind of theoretical approach to guide you. And then if things aren't making sense, then you can go back and look up, you know, what drugs you're on and think if that's affecting the ECMO circuit.
And I would just say, thank God there's guys in the world like you two who think this stuff's interesting. Because, no, I'm seriously, this is obviously critical to taking good care of our patients. And thank God that you guys are into this stuff and to the rest of the pharmacists out there who are helping us out. This sounds super cheesy, but couldn't do it without you guys. So really appreciate you guys at the bedside.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
You know, just a general kind of funny point is that if you're ever calling a physician to make a recommendation and they're kind of on the fence, just say the word pharmacokinetic, and usually they will say, okay.
Yeah. Look glass over.
Yeah.
Lipophilic and right. Hydrophilic. Right. And
the more syllables, the better. Guys, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Pleasure to be on your show, Joe.
Don't forget to check out all of the links discussed in this episode in the show notes at pharmacyjoe.com/episode212. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.